Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on the last weekend of August 2020. Into the fall season here, I've had some fall-like storms moving through, but for me, one of the things that is most indicative of fall is the migrating birds, southbound migrants, songbirds, especially at this time of year, with warblers and thrushes and some others as well. It's been fun to step outside in the evenings and hear the night flight calls of these songbirds heading over as they make their way south. It is usually for me between 10 and midnight, although I think they're going all night. And on some of these nights where we've had low clouds and relatively calm conditions, it's been just pretty optimal listening conditions to hear, even in my downtown neighborhood, to hear these birds flying over. I've been tempted to set out a recorder and maybe see if I can figure out what some of the birds are that are flying over and making those calls. I know a number of them can be identified to species from those calls, but so far I haven't done that. I hope you're getting out and enjoying the last of this season of light and relative warmth. And if you are, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded back in 2018 with a visiting mycologist, Ron Hamill. Ron had spent some time in Southeast Alaska and spent a few days here just seeing what he could find. So we'll go ahead and join the conversation with me asking him about some of his experience in the region. You maybe have been to Southeast Alaska several times, but I know that the Forest Service was doing a survey of fungi on Prince of Wales, and you did that?
Yes, that's right. This was 2013 was the first time they contacted us to do some survey work. There's, I guess, a question about how do old stands and regenerating stands compare over a certain amount of time, and we did a survey of four paired stands that were mid-serral and late serral, or old growth, if you will, on paired soils. So the soils were the same, the aspect was the same, the elevation was the same, so they were very comparable. And so we went through, and the first year we came two visits, one in July, one in October. And we went through and just, we had a defined area to look in, and we would just, you know, cruise the terrain and look for, see as many species as we could find and make general notes on abundance. But really, we were looking for differences in diversity that year. That winter, we did a little bit of analysis, and it was very clear that there was a quite a large difference in terms of both species richness and the number of occurrences of fruiting bodies. And so we decided that the next year we would try to repeat it, but do it in a way that we could generate some statistics from. So we laid out transects and defined the area by a 200-meter-long transect, and it was 2 meters wide. And we recorded every fungi in the transect, recorded the distances, and we divided the transect into 1 meter blocks in order for the statistical analysis. And surprisingly enough, not even surprisingly, but the second year we came up with almost the exact same results, but things that were all, we did three different statistical tests. They all came out very significant. There was, in every case, there was more diversity in the old growth, more occurrences of fruiting bodies, more fungi that had been eaten by mammals. And the species comparisons between the two stands, as far as the types of species there, in general, they didn't share more than about 35% similarity. So there were really quite differences. You could see that there were early serral communities that were still persisting after 80 years, which is quite a long time, and very distinctly different old growth communities.
Of fungi. So the abundance was greater in the old growth, the diversity was greater in the old growth that you were finding.
Yes.
Did you, along these, of course, fungi are many of them, not all of them, but many of them are kind of ephemeral, so that they're not there for very long, at least fruiting.
Right.
Did you do like multiple trips or along a transect, or was it pretty much you went through one and
no, we went through one at a time. Of course, it's always a question of time and, of course, the cost of doing it.
Right, right. Yeah.
So you can only go through so many times, but you wanted to do the two stands as close together as possible, so
right,
that the comparison was as close as you could possibly be. So usually they're always done in consecutive days, so they were really no chance for the floor to change very much.
So you would go through each of them within a couple of days, but not revisit them that year. You went on to your, I guess you had several stands.
We had eight plots altogether.
Yeah. And so was there, you mentioned that between the old growth and the second growth, like 35% or thereabouts, overlap. Was there much overlap between stands of old growth or between stands that were those more overlap?
Much, there wasn't complete similarity even between similar stands across the landscape, but there was much more similarity between old growth stands and the mid-serial stands had much more similarity to each other than to the old growth stands in every case.
Oh, okay. So, and I guess when I say young, it actually isn't that young of young growth, so it's past the stem exclusion stage kind of thing, and
right, some of them actually they varied a bit in age between about 46 and 80 years old. Most of them were above 60 though.
Okay, so these would have been logged in the mid 1900s basically,
right? Yeah.
And of course Prince of Wales is further south than Sitka, a bit warmer. The geology is significantly different. I don't know what geology specifically you were on there, but a lot of karst.
And a lot of this was karst topography.
Oh, okay. Yep. And so, one of the things that I fungi are associating with plants, and I don't, they're immensely diverse across the world and within, any given place, it seems like. But I don't know how much, I know that there are definitely plants that associate with particular geologies, and I don't know how much fungi are, how much are they, I guess there's different roles, so probably some fungi do specialize in certain chemistries or geologies.
Yes, I think fungi, it's hard to, they have so many different life strategies, and so it's hard, you don't really want to think of any one way of going about things, but there definitely are calcophiles, so some of the flora down there is probably quite distinct.
And for Prince of Wales?
Yes.
And so I guess maybe it's worth mentioning for folks that don't know, you gave a talk yesterday, and as we're recording this, it's the day after your talk, but you mentioned the three kind of basic life strategies, I guess, are that you spoke about were decomposers, saprophytic. Mm-hmm. They're decomposing everything, basically. Or various things. Different ones specialize in different things. But then there's the parasites, which actually are attacking living things, I guess, but maybe not decomposing, but relying on living things. And then mycorrhizal, which are partnering, basically. They're in a kind of a symbiosis with the plants.
Right. But one thing I'd like to point out that symbiosis means simply that things are living together,
yeah.
And all of these things are in symbiosis. Symbiosis usually breaking down to two things, either commensalism or mutualism, where both organisms benefit, commensalism, where one benefits and we can't see any harm to the other organism, and then there's parasitism, where one is actually harming the other.
So
but they're all symbiosis.
They're all symbiosis. So in this case, it's mutualism, the mycorrhizal.
The mycorrhizal species are mutualists.
So I was reading, I don't know, it's been a little while, but I saw this, it was an article, like a Scientific American blog or something, and the person was reporting on a paper that had been done, and they were looking at the little bits of rock and so forth in the soil, and they were seeing that the fungi were in there and essentially were just like mining, and I can't remember, it was some kind of crazy number, but basically they would extract the minerals out of these out of the rock stuff in the soil, as well as you mentioned also they're pulling in the nutrients from things that are decomposing. And they're really a major source of nutrients for the plants.
Right. In the environment, really what most fungi are doing is they're ingesting carbon. What they live off is mostly carbon. Of course, they need other mineral phosphorus and things like that. But especially the mycorrhizal fungi, they will take the nutrients that are left behind. The saprobes tend to take away most of the carbon first. And so a lot of phosphorus, nitrogen, and some other things is left behind. So the relative amounts change over time. So the what we call the carbon-nitrogen ratio will change. As the nitrogen ratio gets higher, the ectomycorrhizal fungi have more resources to pass to the trees, and this will actually increase tree growth, which will cause more leaf falling over time and actually more falling trees over these years. Larger periods of time, but that creates sort of a positive feedback loop to the saprobes, which are there to pick up that decaying material, use it for sustenance, and then, of course, leave behind minerals for those ectomycorrhizal species.
So the trees that the plants are bringing in is there. I mean, are they providing the carbon to the fungi that they're?
Yes, their leaf matter. You know, it's most living things are mostly carbon.
Yeah,
and so they're taking away most of that carbon structure, taking the carbon away from the structure, and a lot of what's left behind are these other minerals. And
So like with the mycorrhizal ones, though, because they're not decaying the stuff.
They're getting their photosynthate. They're getting it passed from the tree, and it's quite interesting that sometimes one tree will be attached to a number of different species of fungi, and that fungi may even be attached to a number of species of tree in the same proximity. And they've shown that the photosynthate from one tree will be passed to a different species of tree as mediated by the fungi. Some of the shade intolerant trees won't do very well under the canopy, but yet they persist. And some of the bromeliads, some of the coral fungi, are mat forming fungi, are known to do this quite a bit. But they mediate the transfer of photosynthate from one tree to a smaller unrelated tree, and sometimes even a different species. So it actually helps to regulate the overall health of the forest, which actually helps the fungi itself because it maintains the habitat.
So yeah, when at some point those larger trees are going to die or get knocked down, you know, so then these younger trees there's already trees there ready to take off. I guess that's the release that they talk about. And, you know, at least in Southeast Alaska where we don't have fires, you know, it's the windthrow or most often windthrow, I think.
Yes, I believe windthrow is the largest vector for tree death here.
So when we have all those little trees, they're generally fine when that happens. Then nothing happens to them. They're there. They're just small. They couldn't necessarily have survived when the canopy was you know, closed from the old growth. The larger trees, but they're surviving in part because of the fungi.
Exactly, and you see why that is of benefit to the fungi, because it can remain on site with its mycorrhizal partner that it requires for photosynthesis.
And so, you know, that's all mostly going, well, almost entirely going on underneath the surface where we don't really have, I mean, there's some clever, it's interesting to read some of the clever studies, like they put bags around trees or something and put, mark the CO2.
Yeah, they can mark the different types of carbon, and you can actually, between the ratio of carbon 13 and 14, we can now be sure about whether things are truly saprobes, truly mycorrhizal. And now we realize some of the mycorrhizal species, under difficult conditions, they can move off and do a certain amount of decay too.
Oh, okay. So they have a little bit of flexibility.
Right.
And so what we mostly see when we see fungi are, of course, the fruiting bodies, which are, it's like the equivalent of fruit, I guess, for a tree. Of course, it's very different in terms of the structure and all of that. But that's a reproductive kind of thing.
Yeah, that's for sexual reproduction. There is some fungi, there's asexual reproduction, which is simply just a budding of the hyphae underground, which is very hard to observe.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much all fruiting bodies you see is for sexual reproduction.
So the spores that are coming out, are they're viable as is, basically, that, you know, so a mushroom is formed or a cup or whatever it is, and then there will be spores that are produced there. So is the sexual interaction happen prior to the forming of the fruiting body?
Well, at different life stages, they're monocaryons and dicaryons, so they actually have to meet in the soil. They aren't really male and female. What we refer to them as plus and minus, they actually have to meet up in the soil to form a dicaryon.
Okay, and then that's what will generate
And that will generate into hyphae. Oh,
okay.
And the fruiting bodies are actually monocaryons.
So the
Or the spores are.
The spores are. Yeah. So the fungal reproductive life is a little more complicated, it seems.
There's a bunch of different mating systems. I'm certainly not an expert at it. It's very complex. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, they're just so very diverse in general. Like there's, fungi in general, there's a lot of different groups within there that I don't know how closely related they all are.
Well, of course, the more we look back, we can certainly see that pretty much, you know, everything. And we as humans, we draw lines between things, and but really things happen on a continuum in nature.
Yeah.
The lines are really there for us to be able to.
Yeah. Yeah, and trying to understand the relationships, I guess, is part of the goal of these days anyway.
Some of these things have very different functions in the environment, and it's actually, you know, if you're going to maintain ecosystem function, you really need to, you know, at least be concerned about the well-being of that whole community.
And where you're from, I mean, it seems like fire is probably the major factor in regeneration.
As far as ground clearing events, there's a lot of parasitism. We have some actually, for example, the largest living thing on Earth is a parasitic fungi in central Oregon. It covers, I think, about, my figure might be a little off, but about 6 square miles.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's estimated to be over 4,000 years old.
Huh.
So we have some serious pathogens, but you know they do decrease value in the wood, but they also create structure, which is good for cavity nesters and the likes. They create canopy gaps, which increases the herb layer, which is good for the animals. They have more to eat.
Yeah.
So it's not as simple as just, you know, of course wood value is a concern, but it's certainly not the only issue out there.
Yeah. So I've heard about it. Armillaria.
Yeah. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Largest organism. I guess there's some debate about the aspens and, you know, there's big clonal groups of aspens as well.
Sure.
But
it's a fun debate.
Yeah. For those. But I'm just kind of curious about this. So it's, you know, would you say six square miles kind of thing?
Approximately, yes.
Yeah. And it's parasitic. So it's constantly attacking.
So it's
trees
probably, radiated out over much time. Yes. And it doesn't. It's actually armillaria root rots can be really serious pathogens, and some of the other pathogens, some of the fomatopsis and things, they actually really act very slowly over time. The tree might stand there 400 or 500 years. But sometimes, and especially I've noticed under stressful conditions, the armillaria really take their toll on the trees. We've had a long drought down there. We've had one wet year in the last 10, really, and we have a huge amount of die-off, and armillaria is finishing them off. They were very much drought stressed to begin with, but armillaria is one of the main things that's finishing them off.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. For me, just the maintenance of different. I mean, I wonder a little bit about how. I know fire is one of the important things in maintaining, say, like meadows or prairies or something like that, but maybe fungi are also. I don't know.
Well, one of the wonderful things about fungi is that fires have their own whole suite of fungi. Good fortune in that I'm a mycologist, and the misfortune in that it burned right in front of my house, having a very large fire there last year. And I certainly have an interest in burn fungi, and they were very close by. So I started watching them I snuck into the fire while it was still burning, and within 2 weeks of there were still burning trees all around, and there were already fungi fruiting on the ground, claiming all that soot.
Oh wow!
And there's a progression of fungi, sort of a succession that go on starting weeks after the fire and especially through the first year, but it happens over a number of years. And a lot of people miss this, but some of these are mat forming. They're little cup fungi, but they'll literally be covering 60% of everything. And there's a lot of concern in some of these fires about the amount of soot left behind. Of course, when the sun hits that, it's going to create even more heat and more drying. But I have noticed by the first spring, a lot of those small ascomycetes, they're in the pyrenomycetes, which is pyreno meaning fire, but there's a big group of fungi that are associated with fire. They just gobble up that carbon so fast that by the first spring, you can barely find any black soot on the ground.
So they're, that makes me wonder, like, are they in the soil already, or are they the spores?
Ooh, well, there's some real interesting stuff going on there. You know, we're on an 80 or so year fire interval around there, at least historically. And you would think, well, that's got to be a long persisting spore. And we're not sure about this, but at least about these species. But it's been shown some other things. They can actually live for long periods of time as like leaf endophytes. They're living in the leaves, and then they completely change onto a whole nother lifestyle when the conditions change. I have some colleagues who are doing some research on this, and they're finding things up in the leaves of the canopy that we certainly had no idea were ever up there, and because they're normally ground fruiting species.
Yeah, I remember seeing an article or something about all the endophytes. So endophytes meaning living inside.
Yes, they live inside, and sometimes even a single pine needle can have, good 20 species in there.
Yeah. and so these are things that at that point aren't necessarily really they're not harming the tree and they're not helping the tree, or are they just kind
of it depends on the situation. Some of them have been shown to, under stressful conditions. For example, we have something in Oregon called it actually occurs elsewhere, but in Douglas fir, it's very similar on the coast here, that we have a band of Sitka spruce along the coast. Now, because of the high value of Douglas fir, that some plantations of Douglas fir were planted in the Sitka spruce zone after they were cut. Swiss needlecast is an endophyte that lives in the Douglas fir, and when it's planted in too wet of a spot, for example, in the Sitka spruce zone, the Swiss needlecast will really express itself and really reduce the fitness of the trees. And there's a number of places on the coast where they've gone in and removed the Douglas fir because it was just a bad idea. And things belong in certain places for a reason.
So it may be that, I suppose that could be one of those things that is potentially even helpful, and worse, not really harmful in a certain zone, but you move it somewhere else.
Exactly. It's in every Doug fir. You never see it mostly. It just is there. Some of these things we think actually will be somewhat protective in that they'll discourage herbivory.
Oh, okay.
It's really like everything. It's all across the board, though. You really don't want to say that there's one particular thing going on.
I think one of the other things that I was hearing about is that some of these endophytes will they're helpful in the sense that they discourage other pathogens that come in. Like they basically exclude, I guess,
everything out there, every substrate, and our human bodies are a very nice example of this. We are substrate, our skin, every bit of us is covered with some bacteria. When you use, say, for example, a lot of antibacterial soaps, you're opening up substrate. And if you have a healthy flora to begin with, and you're opening up substrate, you're inviting perhaps something not so healthy to move on.
Yeah.
And so it's something that I think you need to be a little bit careful about. Yeah. You know?
So is it probably the case that our trees here have many endophytes in within the needles and leaves?
Yeah, I certainly don't know for sure, but I will absolutely guarantee that there's many. Even though I don't, that's not my area of study. But I do have a colleague that is an expert in that area, and he works a lot in the Sitka spruce zone, and I'm certain there are many, many, many.
Yeah, how do they? I mean, maybe you don't know, but how do they discover these things? I mean, the microscope?
Well, historically, it was sectioning little section by section of leaves. Of course, we live in the DNA age now, and we find out there's even a lot more species than we even realized before. And some of these do form fruiting bodies at certain times under certain conditions. So if you pick up enough needles and look at them, eventually you tease out quite a lot of species.
I see. So would some of these be just sort of biding their time until the needle falls, and then they'll...
Yes. Well, this is where I was getting back to the endophyte thing. In the case of fire, some of these things that farm large mats over the place, I always see them first on the tips of the burned out fern heads. So I think they may be actually persisting as endophytes on the fern, some of which are very old. And then I can't prove this yet. I have suggested it to some of the people that are working on this. Maybe they'll get to it. But I believe some of these things are must be living as endophytes.
Huh. So even before the fire is completely done, there's already fungi starting to fruit.
I mean, as long as in little bit wetter spots. But in this, like last year, we actually had a little bit of rain at the end of the fall. And I was in there, and there were trees burning around me. But there were fairly large colonies of some of the pyrenomycetes, yeah.
So are they, the fruiting bodies are most obvious. I suppose when they're really growing as a mat, you can see the hyphae kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, some of these almost sheet forming, but a lot of them form little cups, but they're so densely packed together, it looks like almost a solid mat of color.
Huh. And they're...
sometimes in a few square meters, there'll be literally thousands of fruiting bodies.
Huh, wow. And so those are some of the early ones. And I think morels are sort of known or
morels,
associated
there,
with
there are
fire.
Burn-associated morels, and there are non-burn-associated morels. There are probably at least 6 burn-associate species in the West. How many of them are in Alaska, I have no idea. Yeah. I usually see 3 to 4 around the fires in the area of my house. But we also have a number of non-burn-associated morels.
Yeah, and so there's, of course, not so much fire here on Southeast Alaska, but in the interior, Yukon and interior Alaska, there's a lot of – even in Kenai Peninsula, I guess there can be substantial fires, and I know of people that like to go to
I've seen pictures, and from what I gather, the fruitings can be unbelievably large, like just unbelievable quantities.
And so are they going after like the charred wood? Is that what they're kind of
into? Well, again, they're probably, some of these are just like I said, they persist in the soil until there's enough soot and things. When the fire happens, it's a huge downloading of carbon. I had a very interesting thing happen to me this year. I have a colleague, he studies these small little ball-like things called zygomycetes, and I had been collecting a few for him, and I asked him, oh, I've been seeing this one in fires, and what is it? And I thought he'll be able to tell me easily, and he had no idea, so I decided to get to work, and I managed to identify it as this thing called Moticella malleola, and it was actually only – fruiting bodies have only been seen a handful of times in the whole world, and it was not even known from fires. However, I found thousands and thousands and thousands of fruiting bodies.
Oh, wow.
And we learned something new about its ecology. It is a barren associate, and it's a very close associate of some of the snow mold fungi that come out right after the snow melt. You see a hyphae covering the whole ground, and they're both reacting to the same thing. There's a huge dumping of carbon, and they are quick to just colonize it and just grab it all up as soon as it becomes available.
So fun. I mean, this is something that's interesting. There's amazing diversity and the sort of, we've talked about endophytes inside of leaves decomposing and all the different sort of like checking the snowbanks as they melt and like these.
There's
sort
a whole
of very,
suite of things that do just that.
Very hyper specific, micro habitat kind of things that I don't even know. I've heard about slime molds in particular. There's some that are associated with snowbanks. I hadn't heard about fungi, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
There's a whole snowbank flora, actually, that occurs.
Is it likely that we have some of those up here, probably?
I believe so. Especially, I would like to get up to some of the higher elevations here early in the spring, but I need to get up here shortly after snowmelt one of these years, and I'm quite sure there's some really interesting things that are associated with those colder temperatures and snow, probably.
Yeah. So of course, the challenge in part is learning to know where and what to look for. There's a lot of small things. The larger fungi are pretty obvious for the most part. Some of them also can be blend in pretty well. But there's a lot of smaller cups and various other forms that they take.
Oh, absolutely. And some of these are tiny. And like a lot of things, it's a progression. You start out with the big things that grab your eye and are colorful. And I'm to the point now where I'm looking for things that are almost too small to see, and you have to delve deeper and deeper, and our levels of resolution become better over time. And of course, we get the big easy megafauna first, and then we get down to we're still getting down to the bacteria.
Well, and it's even with the big ones though. So it's been interesting, from time to time. And I can't remember, there was a rather large fungus that I ran into, a mushroom. I can't remember the name of it, but I took a picture of it. It was a regular writing pen. It was bigger across than that, so it was a pretty large for here. And I think I showed the picture to Kitty LeBounty, and she knew what it was, but she's like, that, doesn't see that one very often. And so it's kind of one of those things that even with the large ones, they don't always – they may be in the soil, but they don't always fruit. And so,
right. There's been some long-term studies that show some things fruit very infrequently. There are also lots of species that are very regular. Sometimes they don't occur frequently on the landscape, but if you cover enough ground, you'll find them every year, almost every year. But there's some things that appear to be on very – we have our cicadas and things which are on some very long 17-year cycles, and I believe some of the fungi have the same thing going on. What I've noticed in some of the – especially in recent years, since we've had some odd conditions, a lot of more drought in the Northwest than we're historically experienced, some of the times when there's not many fungi out, it's actually when I enjoy to go out the most, because a lot of – you don't find much, but a lot of, and it's both – again, you don't have a lot of big things to grab your attention and get your eye, and you start looking at finer and finer detail. But a lot of unusual things come out under unusual conditions.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so it's kind of this fascinating thing, with birds. People get – it's kind of – there's a little bit of the gambler jackpot, going for the jackpot thing happening, I think, with birds, because they fly around. Most of the time, you just see the normal things. Fungi don't move around quite in quite the same way, so it's not like you never know – You know, when you find one in a place, often, especially if it's a regularly occurring one, you might find it there again or expect to. But you never know when it's going to come up, you know, or you'll see something new that hasn't come up before. So there's a little bit of that, you know.
Yeah, I have a nice walk near my house that I take, probably at least 200 times a year. And I still see new things all the time.
Yeah, it's kind of a... I don't know. I don't think I'm the only one that sort of that. There's a little bit of that jackpot mentality. You know, I never know which time I'm gonna hit the jackpot when I get out there and finding something new and interesting.
But a little interesting point about the diversity of fungi and seeing things under different conditions and stuff. And when you think back to that question of earlier Cyril Forest and late Cyril Forest having more species, the more species you have present, even though there's really in most cases, even with the acromicrotal species, and there's a few real workhorse species. They do the vast majority of the work. But when you have a large suite of species there, you can be much more certain that there's going to be something active no matter what the conditions are.
Yeah.
You know, some of those large fungi that do a lot of the work, if it's dry enough, they might just shut down. But there are other things that will actually start colonizing more of the root tips and doing more of the exchange of nutrients for the thing. So I actually think protecting diversity can be very important for protecting the forest under changing conditions, because you need to have species that can be active in the system no matter what the conditions are.
Well, and so, back to the question of diversity, one of the things that you mentioned is that during your talk is that already primarily based on work on Prince of Wales, but it sounds like you also spent a little bit of time, I'm not sure where, on Chichikov and some time around Petersburg.
Yes, that's right. Last year I was both on Chichikov and around Petersburg. I was mostly in the vicinity of Huna, where we did a little bit of we set up an exhibit in the community and got to meet some local people, and I got to learn a few new things about fungi that I didn't know, and from people that had been going out collecting a long time and seeing things that I haven't gotten to see here. But around there are some very interesting fungi. Of course, again, you get some of that karst topography, and that's all very interesting. But even, to be honest, everywhere in Southeast is fantastic for fungi. I think the diversity here is really amazing. I'm well over 500 species, and I think I've barely scratched the surface.
Yeah, and I guess I don't really have a sense of generally speaking, as you move north, you expect to have less diversity in general, but I don't, but there's the other factor of, well, we have a lot of rain here and moisture is really helpful for some things. And so, I know our plant diversity is lower, but I don't have any sense of like, how does that diversity compare with, coastal California or the mountains, the Cascades or something like
Well,
that?
Well, there's some interesting work because, you would think, because a lot of fungi associate with certain species, whether it's to decay them or as mycorrhizal symbionts. So a lot of them have a lot of fidelity to one species. So you would think the higher the plant diversity, of course, the higher the mycological diversity. And in fact, that's probably the case. But as far as the way when fungi display themselves as fruiting bodies, the most positive correlation to high numbers of species is actually rainfall.
Rainfall. So
yes.
Having a wet place is helpful for finding.
Very wet place. But I believe here that it actually can be, it gets too wet sometimes.
Yeah,
it really
yeah.
slows things down.
Yeah. And cold. I suppose the coolness, it seems like sometimes some of them like to have some, and I don't know whether that's because so I'm not much of a picker myself. I like to go out and see stuff, but I don't really go out with the intention of harvesting. But people who pay attention to harvesting, they're a little more tuned into the abundance of things, it seems like, because, of course, they want to get a bunch of boleads, or they want to get a bunch of chanterelles or whatever. And I've heard, at least the impression that it seems that people have is that when there's a extended period of sunny weather in the summer, for example, you'll tend to have a greater flush of mushrooms coming up, as opposed to a year that was a gray and rainy summer, which we have often enough. So, is that because the plants are in those nice years generating more photosynthate, the carbohydrates that are going into the fungi?
Right. I would at least guess in those nice years that, yes, primary productivity, the amount of photosynthesis going on in the plant community is higher.
Yeah.
Because you have more intense sun and more exposure to the sun. So, yeah, there is more photosynthate available in the system. And even the herbaceous layer is going to, which dies off every – or not all of it, but a lot of it, the annuals die off every year. And they're a substrate for quite a suite of fungi. So, having a – high turnover in that community is certainly going to be good for the fungi.
And so, so will, like, for mycorrhizal fungi, will they fruit more when they have more energy? I mean, I guess it would make sense that maybe they, although some things seem to fruit more when there's a stress. There's like, oh, we need to get our reproductive bits out
there.
Yes,
and I think some of the saprobes especially tend to be stress fruiters because their substrate is running out.
Okay.
And they need to find a new substrate.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
And otherwise, you know, we tend to think things fruit or even flower or whatever when conditions are good, but I believe they fruit for all kinds of conditions because they're stressed and they need to move. They need to get some progeny out there because they're not going to live much longer. I've noticed a lot of the conifers produce a lot of cones right before they die.
Hmm.
They're trying to make sure they got a few genes left behind.
So that might be when they're, like, when they're getting parasitized or something.
And, exactly. Yeah. And a lot of it's been, you know, combination of drought stress and then the fungi being able to really take advantage of them lately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so, you know, around in Southeast Alaska, there's the different trees, and it seems like there are things that are associated with different trees. And I don't know how much, I mean, I'm sure there must be things that are like, they don't really care that much, you know. If it's a conifer, great. But others that are more specific to spruce or hemlock or something or cedar. And then there's the habitats, I suppose. Like you mentioned that the young growth and old growth have a very distinct diversity and abundance of at least based on the work that you've been doing on Prince of Wales. No doubt. I mean, I imagine that it varies from place to place, but probably that pattern persists.
I've seen that pattern everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, but like in a place that I never really thought of, I mean, you know, I'd run into a mushroom from time to time out in the muskeg or whatever, but it seems like you really like to focus on, and maybe it sounds like you're one of very few who actually like to focus on the muskeg for mushroom diversity. But it sounds like you're finding a lot of stuff as you explore the muskeg.
Yeah, absolutely. The muskeg is both. It's strikingly beautiful, and it's something different for me, of course. But I'm finding some very, very interesting species, things that are huge disjuncts. And the disjuncts are things that are far spaced in their known occurrences. Several of the species I'm finding in the muskeg, the nearest locations that they've ever been recorded from are either in the middle of Siberia or Newfoundland.
Yeah. And I suppose that's maybe in part a where people are looking effect.
There is definitely some of that, yes.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen, though, because there's some decent mycologists out there, and they're tend to look at a lot of different. I at least want to think that the Canadian mycologists have been looking up at the northern tier up there and a lot of the muskeg. But but of course, there's only so many people to go around. There's a lot of habitat out
right.
there.
Right. Yeah, Canada's a big place.
Yep.
Well, so is Russia.
Even those, they've only been found in certain spots. You know? So I think even in those spots, they're not frequent. And my experience in the muskeg here, I spend a lot of time in the muskeg when I'm here, and a couple of these things, one of them I've collected twice, but in the same location twice, which tells me it is at least a somewhat regular fruiter. So if it's here, it should be being picked up. And so I think it's really quite rare.
Hmm.
And another one I have found in two locations now, but it's one fruiting body, and I've spent a lot of hours searching for it.
Yeah.
And there's a couple others, a few others I've found once, and I haven't found them again. So I think some of these are truly rare species.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, Newfoundland, I could imagine, it's I don't know if it's hyper-maritime, but certainly maritime.
Yes, it is.
And Southeast Alaska. But Siberia is not really known for its maritime.
No, but there's connectivity of spruce across that whole area. And I believe that has something to do with it. I'm not quite certain, but I believe, and even though these aren't even mycorrhizal species, but I do think the spruce, but there's enough connectivity that things travel through it.
Yeah. So there's relationships.
Yes.
Know. Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting. Just, you know, I am only sort of getting started on understanding fungi. It's a big world.
Well, I think from what I can tell, you know quite a bit.
Well, I'm starting to recognize some stuff that's good, but you know, just starting to like be able to notice stuff in muskegs and so forth. And plants I've spent a lot more time on, but I do notice even with them, like there's just these mysterious patterns of like, there's several species of plants that are on Kruzoff Island, which is close to here. And actually, some of them, you know, they're on South Baranof and some of the muskegs there, but they're not on the muskegs in town here, right close along the road system. And I have no idea why. I mean, like, there's not that much difference between them. They're muskegs, you know, and qualitatively there's similarities, but obviously something's going on.
Right.
And
some of these, you know, could be microclimate, could be predation. Some of that, it's a little too early in the process for me to make a good guess on that.
Well, and that's where, you know, presumably Kruzov, you know, being, it would be even more maritime than like where we were Indian River today. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that far, but it's probably enough that it's a little colder over there, a little warmer in the winter out there. Maybe a little wetter in the summer out there.
Yeah, exactly. I think those things have a pretty big factor. And also, like, for example, the difference between here and, say, some of the muskeg on Prince of Wales and the karst, you know, on top of karst, the pH gradient in there is so extreme. It's mind-boggling, to be honest.
Yeah.
But you can find, and that gradient, I believe, gives you some opportunities to find things that are kind of extremophiles on either end of the scale.
Yeah. Yeah, I've noticed that, you know, there are definitely some plants, if you look at the collections, it's all, oh, this was on limestone. I'm like, well, no wonder we don't find those around Sitka. We don't have limestone here.
Yeah,
so.
In fact, you know, there's very little limestone in Oregon where I am, and usually if you find a little calcareous seep, if I'm doing, say, a bryophyte survey and I find a calcareous seep, I guarantee you I'm going to find something really interesting.
Well, and so, you know, just thinking about, you know, those rare species, I wonder, you know, and again, there's so much country that is so little covered in Southeast Alaska that you know, it's hard to say. If it's a microclimate thing or, you know, a microhabitat that's driving the rarity versus...
And could it be maybe even some extent it's a time thing, because as I understand, these are a lot of accreted terrains and maybe, you know, the periodicity of those different... terrains being created.
Oh, right.
Maybe they even have a slightly different origins. I'm not sure.
It's just interesting to me, you know, like, is it really rare or is it?
Yeah, I know, some of these things from my limited experience up here, but like I said, when I'm here, I am out beating as much ground as I can, that I, at least from what I can tell so far and what other people have seen across the world, they appear to be really rare.
Yeah.
However, some of these things, this might be their real home.
Right.
And they may be, you know, relatively abundant, or there's enough of the intact habitat here that it's still here.
Yeah, I mean, you probably, you know, even only just the last few years, if put about as much or more time of serious fungal work in Southeast Alaska, you know, as anybody, because it's just really not been a lot of work done here, it doesn't seem like.
No, it's really interesting. I've done some... you know, looking into herbarium records and different people's lists from over time. And quite a few good mycologists have been to Alaska, but almost everybody's been to the interior. And Southeast here has gotten very little attention. And I feel like I've been really lucky.
Yeah. Got in early.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking, yeah. Well, and that's fascinating. I mean, I don't know. It isn't that easy to get around. There isn't roads.
No, so logistically, it's difficult. You know, for me, it can be a bit expensive.
Yeah.
And not everybody likes to kneel in water all day.
Right. Yeah, it is a little damp.
But for me, it's my people are all from dark, wet places. So
okay,
it's my element.
Yeah, well, I don't mind it either. It's been. I've had a chance to get out with you a little bit, and it's been fun to see. You know, some of the rare things are. We'll just say they aren't super striking to the untrained eye.
No.
Kind of the little brown mushroom things going on. And that's one of the things that's fun to go out with somebody that has the experience and kind of knows what they're looking for is you know, you get excited. You're like, oh, this looks like something good. I haven't seen this before. And I wouldn't. To me, it's another little brown mushroom. I haven't learned enough yet to know what to get excited about yet. So it's all new for me. But it is, it's fascinating to see how many – And just to know that again, because they're ephemeral, you know, we could go out 2 weeks from now and there might be a whole different set of stuff out. I mean, there'll be stuff that's overlapping, but stuff that we'd find that we're not seeing now.
You know, my job can be difficult and it's not necessarily secure, but I am so lucky. My job is a treasure hunt.
Yeah, yeah.
And every day is a treasure hunt. The conditions can be hard and things, but, you know, I'm about as fortunate as I could imagine, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, and it would be interesting. I know that you're kind of trying to compile the list of stuff that you've seen. Are you also kind of bringing in, you know, the list that other people have generated over the years?
Oh yeah, I've actually been gleaning through a lot of the herbarium records and things like that, and I've working on generating a list of everything that's been found so far in Alaska. I mean, my own list, I'm going to try to concentrate on Southeast because it's a big state. And
yeah, that's no joke. Yeah.
And I feel like I found a little niche down here that I can exploit for a while.
Yeah. Well, you know, even just with plants, there was a preliminary checklist made in the early 80s that I went through, and it included both native and introduced species. And of course, since then, there's been a number of other species reported and so forth. And I think I haven't gone through and really added in all the stuff that's introduced, because there's a lot of introduced stuff. And but it's over 1,000 species of plants in Southeast Alaska. So for me, that goes, I look Icy Bay kind of just outside of Yakutat down to the southern end, all that range. And I have nothing for fungi, it's like, well, it's the stuff that Kitty's found here over the years kind of thing. And there's really very little. It's been nice, with plants and bryophytes, there's at least a preliminary list of things to get started with. Knowing that those are incomplete, and then that's kind of seems like, you're just at the point of beginning to be able to generate kind of a preliminary list at this point.
Yes, I've got a list that I'm actually going to try to publish it sometime this year. I really just have to find the time to sit down and get it all the last little touches straightened up and get the nomenclature up to date and things like that. But I feel like I'm, it's a good working list. There's a long way to go, but one of the beautiful things about fungi and the huge diversity in fungi is the truth is no one lifetime is probably going to get there.
have you had a chance? So Petersburg is not that far from the Stikine River. And of course,
and I might get to go there this year.
Well, that's what I was wondering, the Stikine, especially as you go up the Stikine towards the border, the other places would be, Haines and Skagway going up towards the border where you get into the climate becomes more continental up there, and you get into some aspens, I think, even and cottonwoods, more cottonwoods, certainly. But I imagine that there's just as the climate changes and you get that continental climate, there's a suite of different fungi.
Yeah, they happen along a gradient as you gain elevation, as you get drier, and as you move into different tree species, the community will change dramatically.
Yeah. Yeah, so
there'll be definitely a lot of overlap, but there'll be a lot of real change.
Have you had a chance to visit any of kind of those sort of I guess Hyder's the other one that's kind of like tucked way up in there, almost into an interior kind of, or a continental kind of climate?
Oh, okay. No, actually not as really looking at it. Years ago, I was actually up in some of that country, but I was more or less for recreational reasons and wasn't doing a lot of other things. So, nope, one of these days we're going to try to get there too. So
Yeah, it would be, it'd just be interesting. Again, for me, it's just fascinating.
No, I'm actually trying to, get dispersed sites across Southeast. Of course, I can't be everywhere,
right?
And I actually have to make a living, so
yeah. Yeah, well, that's the my focus is primarily Sitka, but it's interesting to me to think about, well, how is it a little different than as you go different directions? So Prince of Wales Islands further south, the geology is different, a couple of different tree species that occur there that don't occur here. Yakutat's further north and on the mainland, and so it's just it's interesting, the differences. And I don't know if anybody's done much collecting outside of Yakutat, but
as far as I can tell, virtually none.
Okay, so there's Yakutat has, I don't know if you're familiar with the topography there, but it's a big forelands, big mountains.
No,
but
all I know is the fishing is great.
Yeah, there's good fishing there, and then these large sandy beaches with beach meadows, lots of strawberries and stuff there. I imagine there's fungi that specialize in that kind of habitat.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, no, absolutely. Especially some of the dune communities, they have their own. There's a number of dune species that would be real interesting to look for. So.
Are those, well, maybe you've focused mostly on forested stuff. I'm not really sure if there's much in the way of sandy beaches on Prince of Wales. I'm not familiar.
There's some small sandy margins to some beaches. And actually in some of those places, you'll see some elemis, clumps of elemis and stuff, and not a lot of sand stuff. But and some of the true sand-associated species I haven't really seen. But there seems to be some beach fringe species that I've been picking up that I haven't seen elsewhere. And a couple of those are been only collected, very few times in North America. It remains to be seen how frequent they really are.
Yeah, it's just, it is interesting, again, for me to just kind of reflect on the places around Sitka, you know, Kruzoff Island being, again, more outer coastal, but having some extensive sandy beaches. Yakutat having miles and miles of sandy beaches.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's some beach grasses there and things?
Yeah.
Oh, that would be real interesting to look at. There is even some interesting cordyceps species that occur only in those habitats.
Oh, interesting.
One of them that I've been looking for, it's undescribed. I'm trying to find enough fruiting bias so we can get it described. Okay. So.
Well, yeah, I know Raven Radio, the airs in Yakutat, so maybe if there's folks listening that are interested in fungi, if they get in touch with me and have some interesting stuff, I'd be happy to pass it on to you. If you're interested in hearing what people have found in Yakutat area. But it is, yeah, it's just kind of, it's, and I know there's a lot of kind of flat swamp, marshy areas up there as well, as part of that Forelands, and then of course the large St. Elias, you know, mountains and everything going up behind there. My understanding is that some of that country is the fastest eroding country, I mean fastest erosion in the world, kind of the St. Elias range. It's lifting as fast as it's at, but there's so much moisture there and the glaciers are carving it, but there's also a lot of uplift, so it's basically staying as it is, but there's an immense amount of kind of erosion happening there. It's interesting geologically well.
So. Yes, and some of the Ascomycete species especially are, you know, disturbance oriented. So some of those could be quite interesting.
Yeah, it'd be just fun to see what else is around Southeast Alaska. Well, just even what's here, you know, I guess. I mean, there's much undiscovered stuff.
I don't feel like I'm ever going to get to the end of this. So and which I'm happy about.
Yeah, get plenty to work on. So folks that are interested in just sort of, I don't know how many are out there. I'm you know, most people, as any mycologist will tell you, they almost always get asked, can you eat it? And that not all the mycologists are, a lot of them are interested in edibles, but not all of them are. But so for those folks that might be just interested in the diversity of fungi, there's, you know, starting to look small. So I mean, like seeing the big stuff, but starting to look a little closer. Things like looking on animal scat can be a way to find some interesting stuff.
Yep, exactly. That, as we know, that probably needs to be decayed too, or over time we'd have a bit of a mess going on.
Yeah.
So there's a whole suite of species that specialize in that. Like I say, over time you tend to change focus and things and work down to the smaller and more obscure. And I believe everybody does that with any hobby they do or anything. Yeah. So.
Well, and the nice thing about, you know, the current time, I guess, is that there's relatively inexpensive macro cameras that can do really pretty good jobs at taking pictures of very small things.
Boy, mushroom photography has, in the last 20 years, it's gone from being almost hopeless. People would shoot rolls and rolls of film to hope to get one good photo out of there into the canopy. And now in the digital age, it's just magnificent, all the images I get to see. It's actually been a lot of fun with all the people in the world out there firing away.
Yeah. So for folks that are just getting started, chances are, in many cases, you won't be able to get an ID from just your photo. Unless somebody really knows the area.
No, photo ID is hard. And I'm, you know, considered by many to be something of an expert, and I'm uncomfortable with photo ID a lot of the times.
So. Yeah.
Because sometimes when you get to a certain point, you actually know that there are actually six things that sort of look like that instead of one that most people know.
And it's a challenge, but it's a starting place. So you can get get a.
And there's, you know, some of the online places, iNaturalist, Mushroom Observer, and there's some others, and people have their own web pages with a lot of species on there. There's a lot more resources than there were. When I first started this, even to get a key, there were almost no books. It was really difficult. It's been a slow process, and especially the last 10 years, the number of things that have become available has just made it, you know, both easier for me to get, you know, good names on a lot of things, and it keeps it more interesting too, because you're not constantly saying, "Well, we don't know."
Yeah, that was kind of fun. Well, that's what was fun about getting out with you these last few days. It's like, it's not like I've never seen any of the small mushrooms and small fungi, but I was like, I don't have any idea what to do with these. Like, I don't even know where to start. So it was fun because you've spent so much time in Southeast and really trying to dig down and figure out what some of these are. A lot of them you more or less recognize, you know.
Yes, and some of them, you know, they're, of course, they have over time and under different environmental conditions, they can have slightly different looks. But like I was saying earlier, the number of years I have in the field really helps me to see beyond those tiny little changes. And
Well, and you know, it certainly is shortcut for me, the journey, like being able to get out with somebody that spent that time.
Well, it's been pretty helpful having you identify some of the plants and making you realize there's a bit more here than I was realizing. So
yeah, the plants I've spent. I mean, I've been looking at plants and trying to figure out what they were for I guess 20 years ago, actually. This summer was the first summer I started really taking pictures of plants. And I remember going back to graduate school, and I was taking statistics classes with some botany students. And I naively assumed that, you know, if they were botany students, they must know what plants are. So I just was showing them pictures of the. Now I understand that, you know, they're botany students, but they might be studying one plant species, you know, doing one particular thing with it. And there's no reason to expect that they would have any idea what plants were in Alaska. But it was like I was kind of naive about it. And I was showing them all these, trying to figure them out what they were. And it's a slow process, you know, for me, mostly taking pictures, but eventually kind of figuring out what's here.
I think several of these biological sciences, especially as it pertains to looking out in the real world and field work, school helps you learn the process.
Yeah.
You need to go out and do it on your own. If you're going to be any good at any of this stuff, you just need to go and beat the ground and beat the books, because school will give you a good head start on how to go about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really have to take it on yourself. You have to have a love of it. Again, sometimes people, the word amateur, for example, I amateur mycologists. Some people think that's a bad thing. Amateur means lover of. And I would much rather be out with an amateur than with someone who really isn't interested, who happens to have a better degree.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing that people go to school for different reasons. And there's a big difference between a sort of a field mycologist or a field botanist and a botanist that has a degree and maybe works in the lab all the time.
Sure. You know? And some of these things are doing very great things, but some of them study organisms in a way, and maybe they aren't even looking at ecological questions, but a lot of these things truly have never seen the organism they work on, where it lives, or what it lives with, or what it contends with in real life. They might not be studying those aspects of it, but I still think it would be helpful for thinking about the organism.
Well, certainly for my approach, I'm, you know, as I'd like to say, I do data analysis and statistics on one end, and I do natural history on the other, and I kind of leave the sciencey stuff in the middle to other people. But yeah, just getting out in the field and learning what's there. And the beauty of it is like you say, you know, you can spend multiple lifetimes on fungi, let alone everything else. So there's never, you know, there's never an end. You can always just keep going.
Right, and it's really important that we have people that are bridging those communities too. And the French have a beautiful word for somebody who can take something complex and boil it down and make it, you know, digestible for the masses. And it sounds funny to us, but it's a vulgarisateur.
Oh, yeah. And that's what popularizing it.
It simplifies it. Yeah, the popularizing it. And those people are very valuable.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, in this days with the internet and, you know, the citizen science kind of iNaturalist type sites, Mushroom Observer, as you mentioned. And you can really approach it at any level. So it's like, what are you seeing in your yard?
Exactly.
And then get really into it if you want to.
Right. And in some of these sites, there's very different levels of expertise on there. Some people just fire off pictures, never even try. But and there's a little thing about iNaturalist that I particularly love, that people have their little bio or their photo, and everyone's photo says the same thing next to it. So-and-so is a naturalist.
Yeah.
And there's something about that that just makes me happy every time I see it.
Nice. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming in and visiting with me. I know you've been here a few days, but anything else you'd like to leave us with as we wrap up?
No, just get out there and take a look at the world. It's absolutely magnificent place you have here. If you're interested in fungi, the diversity here is just absolutely amazing, and you have a really long season here. I believe it probably starts in May and goes as late until you get a real freeze, which is, you know, for us that love fungi, you guys are very fortunate. You know, we have a very long season, but I spend a lot of the months looking for, I mean, really tiny, obscure things that I have to crawl into a wet spot under a log for, you know. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a good place. And you know, different stuff. Actually, some of it pretty fresh throughout much of the winter even. Just, you know, not as many species that I've noticed. But, yeah, it's definitely stuff to look for. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you, Matt. And thanks for spending some time out there with me in the field. It's been great.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded back in 2018 with mycologist Ron Hamill. He was here to do some fungal surveys and give a talk as part of the Natural History Seminar Series. I want to thank him again for taking some time out of his trip to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, you can find recordings of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven. I'd also love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.